We'll call the meeting to order. This is a Senate Resources Committee. Let the record reflect it's 3:31 p.m. on this Monday afternoon, January 24th, 2011. The record should reflect that there is a quorum. Present are my co-chair, Tom Wagner. Senator Stedman will be here in a matter of moments. He's tied up at the moment. We have Senator Stevens to my immediate left. On the far right, Senator Wilikowski, then Senator French, and myself, Senator Paskvin. The record should also reflect that Senator McGuire has been excused from this committee meeting. We expect that she'll be here on Wednesday. Before we get started, I'd like to recognize first Ann over here and the taking the notes over here, and then Clint doing the telephonic recording and all of that. But anyway, welcome to the Senate Resource Committee. I look forward to working with my co-chair, Senator Wagner, and all the members of this committee. I recognize the knowledge and expertise of this committee and the members in it, and expect that we can and we must work hard to get the work done that this that Alaska needs to have done so that Alaska remains a good place to live and work in. The Senate Resources has jurisdiction over the Department of Natural Resources, Department of Environmental Conservation, Department of Fish and Game, and so we have a lot of activity, a lot of work to be done this session. I would request that Senator Wagner, if you have any remarks that you'd like to make at this time.
No, I'm remark-free today, Mr. Co-Chair.
Before we get fully started, would request that everyone turn off their cell phones. The vibrate settings does interfere with the audio and video transmission, so again, please do turn off your cell phones. The purpose of our meeting today is to hear an overview, and this is from the Department of Natural Resources and Commissioner Dan Sullivan, and after that, that will be approximately 1 hour, and then we have a presentation by Paul Thompson, Director of Policy and Business Development for Ormat Technology, and his presentation will be upon the Mount Spur Geothermal Project. And Commissioner Sullivan, we welcome you to the Senate Resources Committee, and please begin and identify yourself. And
thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Dan Sullivan. I'm the Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources, and to my left is Gene Davis, who is the Director of Support Services at DNR. In our presentation and overview, we do touch on some budget issues, and Jean can answer any more of those in detail that the committee may have.
Excuse me, Commissioner. Ms. Davis, I must admit, your picture in the presentation is one that will be remembered by myself for a long, long time. That's very descriptive what your job is.
Through the chair, I don't think that's actually Gene, but that was our one small attempt at humor, so I'm glad that at least one senator got the joke. I just want to say at the outset, Mr. Chairman, I appreciate the opportunity to testify here and kind of give an overview. I know that there'll be other members of DNR testifying before this committee, and what I intended to do this afternoon was essentially accomplish three things in the testimony. One is an overview of DNR mission, divisions, what we do in some budget items, and I know for all of you this is a review, so I'm going to try and get through that relatively quickly. Second is to give an overview of what I've been doing and hearing on the job over the last 7 weeks. I've been in the commissioner position, and that's really kind of a report back to you on what I've been referring to as my engagement tour, which is really getting out and meeting with all the different stakeholders with regard to DNR. Many of you I've met with one-on-one or as a group. So I was just looking through this. I noticed that some of this is going to be repetitive even to what we've talked about in Girdwood and places. So I'll try and really power through it here. And then, Mr. Chairman, this is a in some ways responsive to what you and Chairman Wagner and I spoke about last week, is to try and get a little bit more detail on some specific DNR challenges and weave that into the presentation and give you a sense of how we're viewing those and what we're trying to do to address them. At the outset, though, before I touch on any of those, I'd like to just mention two things. And I just testified in front of House Finance about a half hour ago, and was testifying in front of House Resources last Thursday. And two just overview points. One is, you know, 7 weeks on the job here. You look at the org chart and everything. I have a lot to learn. Commit to this committee for sure to be burning the midnight oil to get up to speed, but you'll see, and I think, you know, I'm a little bit worried about what the reaction to my last testimony might be. It might be the commissioner who doesn't know anything, because you know, I'm a big believer in when I don't know the answer to the question, I'll just tell you. And they got a lot of that in House Finance last hour and a half. So but if you bear with me, I'm just trying to be frank on that issue. The second issue is on the relationship between DNR and the legislature. I'm very focused on making sure that's responsive, respectful. Last week when we testified under at House Resources, that was our first testimony. I had all my directors come down to that meeting. I think that was an important sign to the legislature how closely we want to work with you. And if we're not, or we're not being responsive enough, I certainly hope that this committee and your members will let me know, because that's something that I'm going to be very committed to. That certainly doesn't mean we're always going to agree, but when we disagree, I think it can be respectfully and in that spirit. So anyways, let me just begin, and this is the overview. And again, I think a lot of this is almost too basic for you and the committee members, but I will just go through it rather quickly. I think it's always good to start at the constitutional foundation of what we're all about, and I think Article 8, Section 1 and 2 are pretty important to this committee. That's the mission of the department, that focuses on conserving, enhancing, and our natural resources for future and present Alaskans. The map actually, I think, is quite useful, though, which is a depiction of different lands, federal, state, or native lands in the state. I think this is a really very important slide. It just depicts exactly how much lands the state of Alaska manages, owns, and as everybody knows here, that's larger than any other state in the country. By far, it's larger than many, many countries. But as this committee well knows, DNR does a lot more than that, and some of the other issues. And again, I'm trying to get through this pretty quickly, just because I certainly want to save time for questions and answers. But there's a lot of other important functions that the agency DNR carries out. As for budget and general employment information, 1,100 employees, different regional offices. You see the budget, that the governor's budget request is an increment of about $1 million from last year's budget. That is the org chart for DNR, and I can tell you when I was first provided that, it was a little bit scary, but that's a it gives you a sense of the complexity of the issues. There was some questions in the last hearing that I just testified at. The white boxes are not an indication that those positions are not full. They're just an indication of the different subdivisions within each of the divisions, and where the kind of what responsibility the two deputies that I have, Ed Fogles, who's actually here behind me, and Joe Balash, in terms of their overall responsibilities. So what I want to do now, Mr. Chairman, is move rather quickly through the different divisions and just give a sense, and again, it's going to be kind of a wavetop view, but a sense of what the mission in the budget and the personnel of the different divisions are. So I'll begin with the oil and gas division, very important division, obviously, to DNR and the state of Alaska. Holds annual oil and gas lease sales, manages exploration and development activities on state lands, conducts resource evaluation, ensures appropriate oversight and maintenance of oil and gas infrastructure and facilities, among other things. And that's a fairly cursory list of the different responsibilities that oil and gas have. Mining, land, and water, in many ways, the heart of DNR. It's a division under DNR that has responsibility over numerous important areas, whether it's acquiring land from the federal government to fulfill statehood entitlements, acquiring land for public purposes, defending existing state ownership interests in navigable waters and easements, managing land and mineral resources, managing water resources and issuing water rights and use permits for personal, commercial, and industrial use. And again, that's just some of the wave tops of what mining, land, and water does. You see there it's 207 full-time. It's a large division. Forestry is our most, from a budget perspective, the most the biggest chunk of the DNR budget there. Two key functions for the Division of Forestry: to first providing fire protection services and related fire and aviation management activities throughout the state, and manages the three state forests, Tanana Valley, Haynes, and Southeast State Forest, for multiple use and sustained yield of our renewable resources there. One point on that, they also are working, I think, quite innovatively with the private sector on the marketing of some of those, particularly timber resources. We've had some good examples, particularly in Fairbanks recently, of a wood pellet mill that came together. It's now employing close to 20 people, $12 million in private investment that is helping with the biomass demand. And I think it's a good example where the state and industry can work closely together. This is another very important division, geological and geophysical surveys, which is essentially focused on determining the potential of Alaska land for production of minerals and examining where exactly those deposits exist, and then cataloging that and working closely with others, industry as well, in terms of the specifics on exactly what the state has. And they've done some really, really impressive work over the last couple of years on digitizing a lot of this information. And it's a division that I've been spending a fair amount of time with just to get up to speed. Coastal zone and ocean management is focused on administering the Alaska Coastal Management Program and the participation in the Coastal Impact Assistance Program, which distributes funds to six outer continental shelf oil and gas producing states to help mitigate the impacts of OCS oil and gas development. Another division, agriculture, three main function: agriculture development, the working with local producers on the revolving loan fund program, and managing the Plant Materials Center. Parks and Recreation, again, you see a significant number of employees there. Oversees the division, outdoor recreation opportunities in Alaska State Parks. Last year, FY10, 5.39 million visitors, 72% of those were Alaskans. There's Gene. That's, again, a very important focus, particularly not only on admin services, but also working on the with the as part of the state recorder's office, which administers a statewide recording system and the UCC central file system.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, thank you. Just going back to the Park and Recreation Park and Recs Division. The last couple of years in the Department of Natural Resources Budget Subcommittee, I know there's been a lot of interest in really trying to expand that, and tourism is such a huge component of our economy here in Alaska. And has there been any discussion in that division, do you know, to expand that, to maybe increase the number of cabins that are available and just make it so that it's easier for Alaskans and tourists that come to Alaska to access our wilderness?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, it's a question that I've been hearing, you know, on this engagement tour from literally everybody in the House Finance, where I just testified. It came up. We had an extensive discussion on that. So the answer is yes. I also want to Ben here. Yeah. You want to stand up, Ben, real quick? Ben Ellis is the recently newly the newly selected division head, and I can tell you Ben brings a ton of energy and ideas that are trying to address exactly that, particularly on the area of looking at kind of public-private partnerships to really jumpstart the access issues and some other things. So we've already had a lot of discussion on that, and again, if there's ideas and thoughts from the legislature, we certainly would be very interested.
We welcome Mr. Ellis.
I just wanted to mention the State Pipeline Coordinator's Office. I think members of this committee have a pretty good sense of what they do. I will mention, though, I work closely with them, kind of a baptism with fire with my team leaders in that group on the recent shutdown and restart of TAPS, and I can tell you that they did a really, really fantastic job in a stressful environment where there was a lot of different direction coming from certain federal agencies on what and what not to do, and so I just wanted to give them kind of a kudos. This is the what we call OPUMP at DNR. It's a very, although not a lot of people, very important work that they do with regard to coordinating large-scale projects in the state, some of the biggest ones that you No, that's a picture of Point Thompson there, is where they focus their efforts. Another important office is the AGEA Coordinator's Office, which focuses on facilitating permitting for the for an Alaska natural gas pipeline under AGEA. The Mental Health Trust Lands Office, which focuses on managing the real property assets of the Mental Health Trust. That's just a quick overview of the Commissioner's Office. And as most of you know, there's also many boards and commissions that are associated with DNR, and there's a list there. So in terms of the FY12 operating budget, each of those slides has a kind of sense of what we're requesting in the governor's budget. This gives you kind of the bigger picture of actually where kind of how those requests fall out in terms of the overall DNR organization. So, Mr. Chairman, the next thing I wanted to do was to, again, kind of give a sense of what I'm hearing with regard to meeting with many key stakeholders, whether they're in industry, whether they're environmental groups, whether it's leaders in different communities, legislators, Native leaders, Native corporations, and to just give your committee a sense of what we're hearing. Essentially, three themes keep popping up. Not surprisingly, what they're listed right here, the challenges that many in the state see, opportunities, and I really want to emphasize that, and then this issue of the need for partnership. Broadly speaking, these are, at least in my discussions and certainly discussions with DNR staff as well, these are some of the big challenges that keep, certainly that have been gaining my attention, but also I think throughout the state that people are continually focusing on. The TAPS throughput issue, I think, from my perspective, is probably the most important. And I just want to relay to this committee, again, not to insult your intelligence, but I think these numbers are they're pretty dramatic. 2006, we had 840,000 barrels per day average. 2007, 734,000 barrels per day average. Last year, the average was about 640,000 barrels per day. So that's a loss of 200,000 barrels per day inside of 4 years. So it's a trend that's looking at about a 6 or 7% per year decline, and it's something that I think everybody's concerned about, and something certainly that as a DNR commissioner I'm going to give an enormous amount of my attention. Related to that actually is the aging infrastructure issue, not only for TAPS, and again we saw that pretty challenging situation a couple weeks ago, having the pipeline shut down and very, very cold temperatures, but other infrastructure platforms, Cook Inlet in particular, and that's something that we've been focusing on. I know the issue of high cost of energy throughout the state is a concern, particularly in areas in rural Alaska and the interior. The gas line, although we certainly made a lot of project, under the AGEA process, a project of this size obviously does not come without challenges, whether it's financing, whether it's markets, whether it's commercial alignment among the producers, and that's something that we certainly will be focused on.
On that point, Mr. Chairman, if I may, pipeline coordinator position is empty. Do you know, or can you tell us when you think it might be filled?
Through the chair, Senator French, it's been an area that both from a perspective of how it's operating, right, and who we would get to fill it is something that I've been very focused on, but I don't know the answer. I've been interested in meeting with potential candidates and as you know, that's kind of DOR, DNR, governor's office, and I think that's something that we're going to continue to focus on. I'd like to get it filled soon. It's important. At the same time, you also want top candidate there with a lot of energy and a lot of knowledge.
Thank you.
If I could, Commissioner, with the shutdown of the pipeline here just a short while ago, do you have an estimate as to how much longer that it could have remained shut down until really we were in a catastrophic position? And then, what, assuming we were to get to that type of a position, what capacity or lack of capacity right to heat the pipeline?
Mr. Chairman, I'd rather have Alyeska kind of speak directly to that, but I can tell you a couple things. The day that there was the decision and the coordination to restart that happened, I flew up to Fairbanks just to be there and be in the room and be part of that because of the massive importance to the state. And again, the state team, the Alyeska team, federal guys at the lower levels, I think, did yeoman's work, working real late hours, the guys doing the actual work on the ground in very, very cold conditions. That's an issue that, and we're looking from a state perspective on kind of an after action and kind of lessons learned there, and that's something that we're going to be undertaking, internally. And I'm sure that Alyeska's doing the same operation. But I think that was a bit of a wake-up call, because I think it's just something that we shouldn't take for granted, particularly the complexities of a restart in, temperatures that were dipping around 30 below zero in certain parts of that pipeline. That is a technologically sensitive and challenging operation. So I don't know that I'm not trying to dodge your question, but I think a lot of us were thinking through the very question that you posed, which was, boy, how long and what are the contingency operations for something that could be very extended? From a national perspective, I think it was interesting and, in my view, somewhat disturbing that the oil that was being imported to replace the oil lost by the refineries on the West Coast due to the shutdown was Russian oil. So it's a great example of immediately when an Alaska resource is not available, we're all of a sudden importing oil from a foreign nation, strengthening their balance sheet, and worsening our trade deficit. And I think that goes to a much broader discussion and issue. But, you know, it could have been for a lot longer.
Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've been asked this a few times, but do you know whether or not the maintenance repairs are deductible under ACES for the TAPS repairs, the bypass lines?
Through the chair, I don't know the answer, Senator Wilkowski. We can get back to you on that. I don't know the answer. Again, on some of these challenges, I don't want to insult the committee's intelligence. You're all very familiar with these. I will say one area, and I'm going to touch on it a little bit more in detail, is on permitting efficiencies, and that's something that's going to be reflected in our budget, but also is something that my deputy, Ed Fogles, is undertaking in terms of coordinating an effort initially at DNR to just look at where there are areas of overlap. I think the issue of timely and certain permitting is really important to the state, and I think that this, you know, again, 7 weeks on the job, I think it's an area where we can make some improvements. One thing that we will do, if there's areas from a legislative perspective that we're finding that, you know, we think may have could be changed, we certainly would let this and other committees know on that. What this next slide really, and it's what I try to do is,
Commissioner, if we could interject, Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, thank you. I think somewhat along that line, but every year when I see the pie chart of how the operating budget is broken down for DNR, I'm always sort of a little surprised that the Division of Oil and Gas is the third highest, that forestry gets 25%, mining, land, and water gets 15%, and oil and gas gets 11% of the budget. And considering that oil and gas accounts for 90% of our state budget, do you think, I'm not saying those need to be, the others need to be less, but do you think oil and gas needs to be more so we can streamline the permitting and provide a better service, have a better understanding of what's really going on in the fields for ourselves?
Through the chair, I think, Senator Wilkowski, it's a good question. As I'm getting a better understanding of my own organization, a lot of that permitting actually goes through mining, land, and water. So you're going to see that in some of the budget aspects I'll mention here, there's actually a fairly significant budget request that's going to try and address those both from the perspective of filling vacancies and then also capital-related projects that help with regard to the IT infrastructure that can help streamline that. So as I mentioned here, mining, land, and water really, in a lot of ways, touches the entire DNR area. And so, but, you know, as we look at it, and we're looking hard at it, if there's areas in oil and gas that we think can be improved with regard to permitting, certainly we're going to, I'm very focused on this issue, and I think it's an important one. It's a little technical, but it's quite important, and my team is pretty deep into it already. And again, you know, suggestions from the legislature would be very, very welcome. In House Finance, you know, there was a specific example that came up of I have no reason not to believe it, but it's very, very slow lag time DNR permitting that essentially drove a company out of state. And, you know, those are the kind of examples I'm very interested in knowing about.
If I could ask a question on your challenges before you get to the permitting efficiencies, The gas pipeline issue is obviously a major topic on many Alaskans' minds.
Sure.
You know, what are your kind of 10,000-foot view of both the large diameter line, in-state line capacities? What kind of where are you heading at the moment?
Well, Mr. Chair, I think, you know, my view at the 10,000-foot level is, you know, we have a process that's going on right now under the AGEA process. I think we've made significant progress there. And we are at the stage right now where there's a focus after the initial open season, where there's a focus on the precedent agreements and the commercial alignment that needs to happen. And that's, I think it's been in the press and everything, that's taken some time. You had TransCanada that mentioned a certain self-imposed deadline, which has come and gone. But those are the kind of negotiations that, as all of you know, are immensely complicated and take a lot of time. So I think from my perspective, you know, having some patience with regard to that process is important. And right now they're under the time frame set out under GEA, that there's other work that's going on in terms of permitting that's very valuable. And I think it's important to understand that it's complicated, and the timeline is you know, there haven't been any red flag deadlines that have actually been missed under that process. But that's not to say that we aren't thinking through. I know that the legislature is under the leadership of Dan Fauske is looking at some of the studies and other things that are coming out this summer, and it's certainly something that we're paying close attention to. We're actually helping them with regard to some of the work that they're doing. So, you know, there's it's certainly going to be a focus of mine, and I think that from the perspective of where we are right now, there's a lot of progress has happened, but we're by no means out of the woods on an issue that's bedeviled the state for decades. So what I wanted to do here was get into a little bit more specificity on some of the challenges that I see at DNR and kind of looking at ways to address these. Again, this is really the first blush for me, 7 weeks on the job, so I'm sure there are more, but these are some of the things that we're looking at and that we actually are trying to address from the perspective of budget and other initiative proposals and items. The first one there, just a little bit more detail on permitting efficiencies and workload. Right now we have a permitting backlog of over 2,000 permits. Okay, it's a lot, and it's a problem. And I think, yes, sir.
What is the capacity of DNR to process that currently? In other words, if nothing else new came in, how long would it take to process the 2,000 permits?
I don't know. I can get back to you on that, but I don't know the answer. You know, I think that that's a backlog that includes big projects, smaller projects, but it's a big backlog. And so,
Senator Willekow.
Yeah, just can you give us a little more description? I mean, when you say backlog, is that weeks, months, years, and where, do you have any idea where the backlogs are located, what kind of permits?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, we can provide you a little bit more kind of granularity on that. If you like, I don't have the direct answers to that right now. From my perspective, that's something that there's going to be a need to really focus on trying to address this. And it's both, we have about approximately $4 million budget requests and capital and operating requests in the current governor's budget. But this is going to be not just more money, but some of the efficiencies, some of the IT work, working with other agencies, looking at areas where there's overlap with the federal permitting process, and looking at areas where, whether it's regulations or even statutes, if there's a way to streamline it, we're going to need to try to address it. So we are looking very hard at that, and I know it's of concern to this committee and many other members of the legislature. And again, on this, as in all these issues, if there's ideas and thoughts or examples, good, bad, or otherwise, on these matters, I would certainly be very interested in hearing about them.
Thank you. And the record should reflect the presence of Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I apologize for being late, but I was meeting with the budget director on your district issues, Mr. Chairman.
Commissioner, please continue.
The second one down there, Mr. Chairman, is focused on federal land conveyances. We've actually made quite good progress on that. Lately, there's still about 5 million acres we need to receive under the Statehood Entitlement Act. And as you get to the smaller numbers in terms of the amount, it actually becomes more challenging because there's a lot of competing interests with other landholders. And so we have a budget increment request of about almost $700,000 on that matter. The third one, which relates to a lot of these, is an increase or a concern about a steady uptick in environmental challenges to our permitting process itself, which of course causes delay and uncertainty, which is what we're trying to actually reduce. So this is something that we have a budget request increment of about $200,000 for DNR and about $300,000 for the Department of Law that would be focused on these related issues. Let me try and get through these relatively quickly. Forest management issues. We have an increment request, again, of about $400,000 with regard to maintaining existing forest access roads and investments in reforestation and commercial thinning, and also a bill that the governor introduced, the Southeast State Forest Expansion, which would double the size of the state forest in Southeast, and that's coming from state lands, but it would be dedicated to forest lands. The last two there are in some ways unlocking resources and publicizing resources. This is, I'm going to touch on a slide, a few slides down that will show you, and I think, again, this committee is quite aware of exactly the storehouse, as the governor has been referring to, that we have here. And it is obviously world class, but I do think that looking at ways to publicize that and the opportunities there is something that we're very focused on. And there's a lot of creative ways that we can do that that don't necessarily cost a lot of state money, and that's one thing that we're looking at. Finally, I have two other specific challenges there. One is related to management issues, and that's something that I've heard from a number of people, another number of legislators, which is the challenges in general of managing the entire department. And that is because of the importance of the oil and gas division and the oil and gas issues. There's kind of a gravitational pull on those matters, and a lot of times the other issues, agriculture, things like that, can be neglected, and it's something that I'm looking very hard at trying to make sure that there's a broad sense of management from the top on all the different divisions, and stay tuned on that one. And then retention and recruitment. We have a number of vacancies, too many in my view, and I think it's very important to try and recruit the best and brightest. It was something, as the Attorney General, I was very focused on. It was something that we made some good progress on at the Department of Law, and I think it's an area that we certainly can put a lot more attention to, and we're already doing that. So those are just a few of the many challenges and some specifics that we're looking at from a budget perspective and otherwise. to address those. But what I really want to do in terms of wrapping up here is, and again, a lot of this is not new to this committee, but talking about the opportunities. And I think it's always important to remember these and reflect upon them. And if I can just go down a little bit, but you see a number of these here mentioned. But there is Alaska as the storehouse, right? The North Slope Basin still remains a very much of a world-class basin. Those are USGS numbers. Those enormous numbers don't even include the massive potential of the unconventionals, whether it's heavy oil, viscous, or shale. Something else I had my staff do, and I mentioned this, is that if we looked at the state, not as a state compared to the other states, but as a country, where would we line up on a lot of these other minerals, what we have in terms of...
could interject on the 43 million barrels, is that on state land or combination of state and federal?
It's a billion barrels.
Billion, excuse me, 43
and
billion.
It's both. Yes. It's the whole North Slope Basin. So that's federal, absolutely, federal and state.
Do you have a ratio of what's federal and what's state on that 43 billion?
No, but we could provide. We could get that for you. A lot of that's federal. OCS estimates. This is, again, the USGS estimates that came out in 2008 were enormous on the Arctic and the Alaska Arctic in particular. The numbers were very, very big.
Just so I understand the category, so that includes Outer Continental Shelf, not just mainland Alaska.
That includes the Arctic. Yes, that includes the OCS. But what was interesting when I had asked my staff to come by, and again, these are all estimates, is that on these categories of minerals that they took a look at, if you look here real quickly, we're literally in the top 10 in the world in every category that they took a look at. So gold, zinc, silver, rare earth is much more difficult to assess, but certainly enormous opportunities there. And again, that's reflected in the governor's budget and some of what he talked about in the state of the state.
Yes, Senator Stevens.
I don't mean this to be a gotcha at all, but how do you consider renewable resources versus non-renewable resources? I'm specifically talking about, I don't want to get too far into the pebble issue, but when you've got an area that has both renewable resources and non-renewable, how do you consider that as for state responsibility, and how do you as a commissioner approach that really tough subject?
Right.
Because we're dealing with it every day.
Through the chair. Senator Stevens, it's a great question, and I don't think there's an easy answer to it. And the one thing the governor said, I've said, I don't think the state's looking to trade one resource for another. I think the goal is to responsibly develop our resources in a way where you're not having to make that choice. And I think the state actually has a pretty darn good record of being able to do that. And whether it's preserving our wildlife and developing our oil industry. There's a number of areas in which we've done this quite well on the North Slope. So it's a great question. It's something that I certainly have already given a lot of thought to. But I don't always think that it actually, that the choice is created as an either-or issue. Let me just touch on a couple other opportunities and what we see as very, very positive aspects about what's going on in the state. And that is, as you mentioned, Senator Stevens, the renewables that we have here, obviously we're just scratching the surface in some ways. And there's a number of new players, and I can get into that if you'd like, that are coming to Alaska and see Alaska as a place of opportunity, and I think that that's important and a trend that we certainly want to try and continue. And then there's the issue of, and again, this is what, just 7 weeks on the job, getting out, talking to people, but there certainly is a sense of ongoing innovation among both homegrown companies and companies coming from out of state to work on different areas. And, you know, I think the state has a long tradition of, in some ways, spurring innovation given the harsh climates and remoteness. And that's something that I've seen is very much ongoing. Finally, I just want to end with, and I know I mentioned this down in Girdwood when I saw many of you, so I won't dwell on it too long, but this issue of the importance of partnership, which is what so often I've been hearing about kind of when I've gotten out, and how it's the key issue, whether it's partnership between the executive branch, the legislature, different industries, environmental groups. If there's a sense that we can move forward on these projects and there's common interest on them, that issue of partnership is going to be the critical thing that gets many of our resource development opportunities moving. And as I mentioned, and I've mentioned before, you know, right now the one thing that's a frustration is that we've seen that one of the key missing elements to that partnership equation is the federal government. And I don't want to sound like a broken record from my time as the Attorney General, but this is not just rhetoric. It's on so many different specific projects where we have seen problems with regard to permitting, problems with regard to critical habitat designations, 404C under the Clean Water Act. The list is long and it's growing. And one of the things that we certainly will be focused on is redoubling our efforts to work with the federal government and try and explain the importance of these projects not only to Alaskans, but, as I mentioned, to the United States of America in general, national security, energy security, so many things, whether it's opening up NPRA, ANWR, that could help our country address some of the broader problems that it has, exist up here. And I think it's important to continue to try and make the case, and I think it's important for all Alaskans to try and make that case. We have, all of us have so often a interaction with federal officials that if everybody's making that case, I cited in my previous testimony what I thought was an extremely powerful op-ed written in the Anchorage Daily News yesterday by Tara Sweeney of ASRC on this issue. And she laid it out in really, really powerful prose about how the lack of cooperation is hurting people on the North Slope and people throughout the rest of the country. So I think it's something we're going to be focused on, but I think it's also something that all citizens of Alaska need to take up. Finally, in conclusion, I just had two slides here kind of painting a picture of sequencing of opportunities that could come online with regard to the resource development area in the next 5 to 10 years. And if you look at kind of how these could be sequenced, you could see by 2020 a very, very positive, promising, exciting future for Alaskans, and I think importantly for our kids. And I think there's also a more bleaker look at what could happen. And if things don't come together and we don't get the federal cooperation that we need, it can be a little more of a sobering vision of the future. And I think that last bullet in some ways is the one that would really be tragic if our children and the next generation of Alaskans don't see this as an exciting place with a bright economic future and we start to lose them. And I don't think anyone wants that. So I'll leave you with this slide because I think it's clearly the doable slide. It's going to take a lot of hard work, but I think the working in partnership, particularly with this body, is going to be critical to getting to that bright future. So thank you, Mr. Chairman. I know I went a little long, but appreciate the opportunity to testify.
On the Commissioner, on the issue of the throughput issue and the Department of Revenue January 18, 2011 report, you know, there were some aspects of that report that point out the lack of information that's being processed by the state, and how do you see in the DNR, you know, you not being able to receive information that the Department of Revenue says that while it may have it in its system, they can't process it or use it?
Mr. Chairman, I think you mentioned this to me last week. I think it's a good question to it's a very legitimate question to raise and to look at. As I think I mentioned you, when we've had good examples of when we've had very concrete data from energy companies, and now I'm talking in terms of the specific example of royalty modifications. What has taken place in that context is specific, often confidential, detailed information with regard to the economic aspects of a project. And DNR has been able, particularly in the last two of the most recent fairly large fields to come online on the North Slope, Ugarit and Nikaichuk, the work that was done based that helped kind of close the deal for those fields was done in large part, not large part, but to some degree on the royalty modification matters, and that was done with very hard specific data that we could make decisions on. So it can be done, and I know that you and others have raised the issue of kind of what the Department of Revenue was saying with regard to the usefulness of the data, and I don't have a real specific answer other than I think you're raising a legitimate question. And I know that in other contexts, we do get good data that upon which the state can make decisions that we think are in our interest and can help spur investment.
Senator Wagner.
Just one thing that stood out when I looked through this, I've been kind of twisting over my mind. But going back, kind of what Senator Wilikowski asked, but in a different way, you have 105 positions in oil and gas, and then the next thing I see is 280, I believe, in forestry.
Right.
So kindly break out forestry into what is a production forest, in my mind, that you're producing forest product off of, and what we're just managing, so I can see why we need 280 people there versus 105.
Right. Well, Mr. Chair, I can get back to you on more specifics, cause I don't want to kind of say something that my Division of Forestry team later kind of says, you might have been wrong, but which is certainly possible. But I do think a lot of those numbers are actually focused on the firefighting responsibility of the division. And I can get back to you on the specifics. Is that correct? 181? Yeah. No, it's quite significant. And and that is that's force management. Yeah. I mean, it's the quick view of the numbers, about 3/4 to 1/4 on firefighting. And I think that that's, particularly in the interior, those are pretty important issues with regard to keeping buildings and structures and air quality at a decent level.
But this says it does the 280 full and part-time budget positions, and then in brackets it says it does not include the hundreds of fire season crews.
I think that's in addition. Let me,
thank you.
And I'm only inquiring about the 280.
Right.
For the record, my name is Jean Davis. I'm the Director of Support Services, and the numbers that are a good portion of what we have is in the fire preparedness component. So we have a lot of our wildland fire technicians that we have on staff, permanent seasonals. It was 133 are those. And that's the core of being prepared. We have our warehouses prepared. We have our aviation contracts, our helicopter contracts, our retardant contracts. We have to work all of those things. We have to have folks to manage those contracts. So a good portion of that is all in the preparedness budget.
Okay.
The firefighters not included there are the ones that we have the crews when we actually have fire activity, and we draw additional emergency firefighting crews at that time.
Okay.
Any further questions of the commissioner? I would make the comment that with respect to your 7 weeks on the job, that it's not what any of us know or do not know today. It's what we know tomorrow, and I'm optimistic about your knowledge tomorrow. And as you get your feet more firmly planted on the job, I'm looking forward to further discussions with you and for coming today.
Great. I appreciate it. Thank you for the opportunity and look forward to working with all the members of this committee. Thank you.
We'll take a brief at ease while we get ready for the ORMAT presentation. We'll bring the Senate Resources Committee back to order. We now have before us Paul Thompson, the Director of Policy and Business Development of ORMAT Technology, and he is here to provide us a presentation today about the Mount Spur Geothermal Project. So we welcome you to the committee, and please state your name and identify your affiliation.
Thank you very much. It's an honor to be here today to talk about that other resource that is prolific and we hope to develop in Alaska, and that's its geothermal resource. For the record, my name is Paul Thompson, and I'm the Director of Policy and Business Development for ORMAT Technologies. And today I just want to give you a brief presentation. I'm going to try to stick to a 15-minute threshold here on all the work we've done at Mount Spur, and then really try to answer any questions that this committee may have, and also just touch on some of the barriers. We gave a presentation like this to the House Resource Committee in March of last year, so this is an updated presentation on that, but this is the first time we've had the honor of presenting this project in the Senate Resources Committee, so thank you. ORMAT is a publicly traded company, so while I expect my expectations to be on target, if they're not, the future may differ slightly, and please keep that in mind, and that's for the lawyers in the room. Basically, what I want to do today is give you an introduction of ORMAT, our project timeline, go through the needs of this project as we were requested to do to the House Resources Committee. So that kind of explains the bulkiness of the outline, but really touching on each one of these topics and where sometimes it's not a barrier, but we've actually had good success. We want to comment on that so this committee knows where things are working. For those of you who don't know ORMAT, we are the leader in geothermal development today. We are responsible for over 1,000 megawatts or 1 gigawatt of generation around the world utilizing our equipment. We own and operate over 500 megawatts of geothermal projects, and what makes us very unique is that we are vertically integrated. We design and manufacture equipment, we own and operate projects, we do the drilling and exploration, and negotiate the contracts of development projects. That financial model has made us very flexible. We can sell equipment to third parties, we can enter into unique financial situations, and we bring our own capital to projects, which allows us to develop projects when sometimes high interest rates and other financial models wouldn't permit a project to be viable. Today we employ about 470 people in the United States and over 1,000 employees worldwide. As I think I mentioned, we have a presence in 71 countries. This map kind of outlines for you where our geothermal power plants are, where our recovered energy projects are, and our remote power units. Recovered energy generation is simply where we use, instead of the heat from the earth, we can use the heat from an exhaust pipe to heat a working fluid and produce additional electricity with no new emissions. This is helping turn our nation's natural gas pipeline infrastructure actually into a source of clean, reliable energy on compression stations. Remote power units is actually how we got started, and kind of kicks off our commitment to Alaska. We, in 1975, we sold over 100 remote power units to the Trans-Alaska Pipeline to control the remote gate valves to shut off the pipeline should issues, like I think recently discussed, occur. That equipment is still there, and it really gave Ormat its first foothold in the United States and allowed us to move our corporate headquarters from the Northeast to Reno, Nevada, which is our corporate global headquarters today. The remote power units are fossil-fueled, very reliable small units. Ormat then really focused on geothermal development, and we actually tested one of the first geothermal units in Alaska in 1979 at the University of Alaska Fairbanks at Manly Hot Springs. We supplied the equipment, ran the tests on the technology, and today we've sunk almost $5 million into developing what we hope to be the first commercially viable large-scale geothermal project in the state. For a brief kind of recap, what we do is we look for areas that have heat, permeability, and water. We need those three variables to create a geothermal reservoir to transfer the heat to make electricity. The Mount Spur project is a volcanic resource, so we know there's good heat. Now, what we still need to prove is permeability and the availability of water to transfer that heat to the surface. Prior to 1985, most geothermal projects utilized steam turbines, and it really limited the geothermal development in the United States. Ormat came and brought with it this idea of a binary system. What's different is previous to that, you drilled a well, the water came up out of pressure, turned into steam, and then turned a steam turbine. What we said was there are places where you don't have to have steam. We could use hot water, not let it turn to steam, heat a secondary working fluid, which happens in a vaporizer, which is the big vessel in the middle. It heats a secondary working fluid, which vaporizes for us, builds pressure, the pressure wants to relieve itself across a fan blade. We take that thermal energy, convert it to mechanical energy, and can produce electricity. This technology proved to be very viable in places where you had water-dominated heat resources, and today it's the most prevalent technology in the United States. In the last 10 years, Ormat's been responsible for 90% of the deployed geothermal projects in the United States. So, what is so good about geothermal energy? Utilities really like this technology because, A, it's baseload generation. And what I mean by that is once we build a project, it produces power 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 52 weeks a year. And that baseload characteristic is very easily incorporated into integrated resource plans or planning that matter, energy planning for the future. It's also very cost competitive. We tend to develop projects in the lower 48 between $4,000 and $6,000 a kilowatt hour, or kilowatt, excuse me. In Alaska, we've adjusted that. We think it's a bit higher, close to $5,000 to $6,000 a kilowatt, or $5 to $6 million a megawatt. That number can seem staggering at first, but you have to realize that that is incorporating the lifetime supply of free fuel. These projects are highly reliable. We've had over 30 years of experience of operating these projects for utilities, and we've achieved a greater than 95% availability factor. And when I say that, that just means that the plant is up and producing megawatt hours greater than 95% of the time. Our design is very low entropy. There's not a lot of extreme pressures or extreme heat. And once the reservoir is designed correctly, they sit there and just kind of purr away. Again, the technology is proven. Utilities don't always feel like they're taking a huge risk on this because they can look at thousands of deployed megawatts around the world and say that this is a proven technology. It's merely trying to find the resource. Fuel cost. You're going to hear, I think, a lot of debate this session and future sessions about where the cost of electricity is going in the future. What we can offer is when we develop these projects, we offer a fixed price over a 20-year period. We typically enter into a power, what we call a PPA or power purchase agreement, and we lock in a fixed price with some type of O&M escalator that's negotiated. The closed loop system is great because we don't consume any water. We have zero emissions. So environmentalists tend to really support these projects, and we have minimal surface disturbance for how much electricity we actually produce. So we don't have huge, we don't take up thousands and thousands of acres. A typical 30-megawatt power plant takes up about a 5-acre pad for the heat exchanger and air coolers and things. 20-year contract, 20-year project creates long-term and high-quality jobs for a long time in the state of Alaska. Development inhibitors typically are the resource. It's hard to find good resources. Alaska is blessed with a couple great geothermal resources and volcanic activity. The other inhibitor is a high upfront CapEx or capital expenditures and the risk required in order to develop these resources. As I stated, Ormat's in a unique position. We're willing to invest our own capital in these projects as we move forward, if we know that we can get a contract to move that electricity to market should we be able to develop this project. As I said, deployment, there's over 11,000 megawatts of geothermal deployed nationwide. What this slide, we've included this to say is that states and nations that have been very aggressive in developing geothermal resources have created policies to help that, whether it's an RPS or whether it's tax incentives. The policies have needed to jumpstart utilities looking at this resource, kind of getting out of their comfort zone in typical fossil fuel development. And once that occurs, utilities start to recognize these intrinsic attributes of this resource, and then the quality of the energy production, cost, and reliability tend to speak for itself. Now let's move to the Mount Spur project specifically. It's located 75 miles west of Anchorage in the West Cook Inlet. We've got additional maps if any of you would like to get a little more specific than these great Google Earth images. The estimated timeline. We are looking, we are at 2011. We have begun our non-intrusive, we've completed our non-intrusive exploration and began our exploration drilling. We want to have this project online by 2016, so that's in the next 5 years. And that would be our initial 50 megawatts project. When you look at these arrows and kind of where they correspond on this timeline, you'll notice that a power purchase agreement is kind of crucial to us moving forward. We haven't entered into that the phase, and I think we'll talk about that as a business inhibitor moving forward. We leased 36,000 acres from the state of Alaska on October 2008, paid about $3 million in bonus bids to win that lease. And like I said, in 2010, we drilled two exploration core holes to 1,000 feet in depth. The core drilling was a fun time this summer. Our geologists got to learn what doing work in Alaska was like, staying away from the bears and things. But more importantly, the results started to show, as we had presumed, that there is a prolific geothermal resource. Shallow water showed good heat, despite being under a glacier. There was evidence of multiple geologic faults that are very good for this type of development. And the geochemistry indicated that the water molecules had reached a very high temperature in their lifetime. And this is something that our geochemists can look at and start to really try to delineate this reservoir.
Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, thank you. Do you see any problems with putting this at the base of an active volcano? I mean, this has caused huge problems for the storage tanks for Chevron. I mean, is this a problem that you should be concerned with or we should be concerned with?
Through the chair to Senator Wilikowski, good question. You know, most of the expenditure for us is finding the resource. What happens on the surface inherently isn't that important, and I only say that because we operate large geothermal projects on the Big Island of Hawaii and in Indonesia where we have active lava flows. And once we have defined where this resource is and drilled at depth to find it, should there be a volcanic eruption, we have safety measures, of course, put in place for our employees to get out of the way. Albeit, you know, Mount Spur is a different volcanic structure than the Big Island of Hawaii, but we can put in GPS applicators and things and come back to a site after a lava flow has occurred and still find, you know, those target areas that we have found from a resource perspective. Now, from a business development perspective, we have to take out insurance on those projects, obviously, but it's not a showstopper for us in bonding and insuring these facilities against natural disaster.
But I mean, I guess what I'm more concerned with is the placement of, I assume you're going to have an electrical generation facility very close to there. And, I mean, is that a problem? Is this the area where you're putting it, would it typically be impacted by a volcanic? I mean, we've had volcanic eruptions every 20 years or so.
Through the chair to Senator Wilikowski, I don't think it's a problem in the fact that putting another plant back there is not a problem. We are going to pick a flat spot that we feel is very safe and secure in its location, albeit, you know, how we can predict what's going to happen in a volcanic eruption, you know, God and us will find out. But the big cost and expense in developing these projects is defining the resource, not the physical facility itself. So should we have to come back and replace it, it pales in cost to developing the initial resource. So, you know, we try to prepare for those and have been able to date, no geothermal plant has been wiped out by a volcanic eruption. The question also often turns to earthquakes. Earthquakes, you know, we tend to be, and questions have come up, you know, is there a relationship? There's a relationship in the fact that where volcanic activity and geologic shaking and earthquakes occur tends to be where the magma and geology are conducive to very good geothermal development. The continental spreading in Iceland is great for geothermal development, and when they have seismic activity, it actually tends to enhance the wells because it creates better permeability and water flow. Now, should an earthquake, you know, split right down the center of a plant, you'd have to replace the facility itself. But again, the facility cost is about half of the total development cost, so it's recoverable if need be.
Yeah, I was interested in your comment about the water and the analysis of the water. So is what your people said is that water has been much hotter than it was when they sampled it due to being deeper? Would that be a correct statement?
Through the chair, absolutely. So at some time in that water molecule's life, it's been somewhere very, very hot.
They can tell that by certain tests.
And then with deeper drilling, which we want to do moving on in this, we want to clearly delineate that by drilling a full-scale production well. And, you know, what we can tell from slim holes is preliminary, and we want to move on to the full-size production well to see, to monitor the flow rate, the actual heat at depth, and be able to, you know, really confirm those results.
Yes, Senator Wade.
So going further on that then, I would say probably by 2012, 2013, sometime in there, you'll know more about what your ultimate output could be as far as how many megawatts of electricity you could build to?
Through the chair to Senator Wagner, yes, is a short answer. I think if I can continue with the presentation, we'll just kind of elaborate on it's not quite that easy. So going through the presentation, let's just – what we want to do in 2011, we've gotten funding through AEA, and we're matching that to drill additional deeper 4,000-foot core holes to, again, look at any anomalies in water temperature, permeability, and see if it can support a full-size commercial geothermal project. The next step for that would be to drill a full-size production well, and we hope to do that in 2012. Again, drilling a full-size production well gets us there. We need pretty much two additional full-size production wells to create the flow we need to then get the true measurement of how many megawatts this reservoir can support. Infrastructure needs. This project is about 40 miles from the T-line at the Chugach's Beluga plant, and preliminary studies through an HDR report have said that 40 miles of transmission line and 25 miles of permanent road access could range from $70 to $80 million. We have pulled that out of the cost of this project, but in the cost slides I'll get to in just a second, we'll show you what that would mean. The question here, and I think, you know, as we meet with these committees, we want to get your opinion of should these infrastructure costs be borne by the project or by the state or by the ratepayers in paying for a higher power price for the development of this project.
Senator Wegg.
One other question about that. I would like to see, and maybe you don't have it, maybe you do, but I'd like to see an overlay of this area showing your project and your proposed transportation route, Chewitna Coal's project, their proposed road transportation route, and the Siri coal gasification and their proposed transportation route. Because all I'm thinking is, why would we want to build a road each if one road could, in some cases, supply a transportation corridor to all three projects or a portion of them? So if you have a overlay of this one you have here on page 18, if you can get a good size overlay of that to my staff, then we can get the other people to give us the similar overlays and then take a look at it.
Through the chair to the senator, I think that's an excellent idea. We hired a third-party HDR report to come up with double proposals, looking at different routes and different routing, and came up with this number as really a base to start with. We've given that to the governor's office. We'll give it to your staff. And you've reminded me of a point that Chugach, through the AEA round four, it's going to be, I guess, suggested and approved by your committee if they should receive funding for a detailed routing study. And I think it's about $600,000 they're going to receive to look again at this area and those projects and come up with their best impression as well, so that you should have ample data on those routes. We're not advocating for any one. We just wanted to start that discussion with an HDR report.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator French.
Along those same lines, you know, it strikes me that you're right there at the base of Lake Chacachamna, and I don't know what conversations, if any, you've had with the folks who have proposed a hydroelectric project there, but that seems to me like almost perfect, you know, overlay of projects carrying power from one region to another. You know, I don't know if you've broken up the cost of the road versus the cost of the transmission line, but is it about 50-50? I mean, how much is the transmission line roughly? Do you know?
To the chair, to Senator French, I'd have to go back to the HDR report specifically. I know different routes had significantly different costs, and yeah, the Chacachamba facility is there, and it would benefit, I think, from the transmission and infrastructure. There's also some Siri projects in the vicinity, as Senator Wagner alluded to, so I couldn't agree with you more.
Thank you. Thank you.
Pleasure. The expected amount of power from this project, initially, as we said, the first phase, 50 megawatts. We hope that the reservoir could sustain, and after developing that, we kind of have an incremental approach. We would then look at developing the project further to 100 megawatt potential. And again, that's at a 95% availability factor. Likelihood to completion. The technology, we are not concerned about. As we've said, there are thousands of deployed megawatts of this technology, so it's not, you know, I think this committee, when they're evaluating technologies, needs to look at how many have been deployed, has it ever been done, and in this regard, it's very likely that this should work. Resource-wise, like we said, the preliminary geological analysis is very encouraging, and we're going to need some more exploration work to prove the exact size, but we're very confident of that. Business-wise, however, we're running into issues of how do we get the power to market? How do we get a PPA to either a utility or all eight utilities or with the state or some guarantee of a fixed price over time to help us pay off this project should we be able to bring it to market? We're getting to the point where it's hard to put more private capital into this project without knowing what the power price is going to be. So as we move forward, keep that in mind. We'll come back to that. Permitting roadblocks, you know, we have nothing but positive things to say. DNR, ADEC, AOGCC, USF, Fish and Wildlife Service have all been good to work with. In the last session, we moved some of the authority for geothermal permitting into AOGCC, and we've had no major issues with the preliminary exploration, and it's actually been better than some of the permitting issues we've run into in the lower 48. So for geothermal resource development, we seem to be doing well there. No major challenges we've identified as we look forward, and we're really kind of trailblazing in this regard. I would give them even more credit that they're working with us as we encounter new issues that haven't really been dealt with in the geothermal development. Slide six, you know, we have worked aggressively to work with all the potentially impacted parties. We have met with every Rail Belt utility CEO. We've met with the new Arctec Group and MLMP. I separate them because they're not part of the Arctec Group. All the CEOs think that this is the best viable project in the near term to offset some of our some of the gas issues coming up. The communities have been hugely supportive and recognize the economic development of this project. The environmental and renewable energy communities have been there. We've hit kind of one, you know, the issue with the utilities is price. They love it. They want it really cheap. And we are, you know, we have a difference in price there of about 3 cents. And you have a question?
Well, two questions. Question was on price. To the extent you can, talk about where you're at and where the utilities are. But before that, question on, you said this was a closed loop. In other words, you won't be pulling water out of any lakes or rivers or anything like that to feed and then heat?
Through the chair to Senator Wilkowski, absolutely correct. Even the geothermal brine that we use, we reinject 100% of it back to the reservoir to be reheated. So that's a closed loop system. And the facility is planned to be air-cooled. So the working fluid that we use turns into a vapor. We cool it with the cool Alaska air. It recondenses into a liquid. Zero emissions, zero water consumption.
And on the rates, we're going to get to that.
We're going to get to that. So going back, we bring the cash. We plan to use our own equity in this project if we can secure this power purchase agreement. We've been awarded $2 million from the AEA in the Renewable Energy Grant Round 3. That was to do this initial exploration work in 2010 and 2011. We have been recommended for an additional $2 million in round four that will hopefully be approved by the legislature soon. That comes with a match from Ormat of about $3.7 million as well. We typically refinance the project using term debt at the completion of the project. So what sets us apart from other developers is we're not paying high interest rates on project financing during the exploration phase. We bring the project online, we prove its viability under contract, and then we look for term debt at a much better rate than you would get during the exploration and risk phase of these projects. So, slide eight, the cost. This is the exciting page. Today, we are looking at a price we would need between 12 and 13 cents a kilowatt hour to make this project viable. With a negotiated escalation, we have 1.5% on there, but that could be negotiated. In that power price, we convey all of the green attributes to the off-taker or utility. So that's should carbon become worth something or NOx or SO2, the utility or whoever off-takes that power is guaranteed all of those attributes. We have it as a bundled package. We also sell the energy and capacity. If the utilities get in here, they'll talk about energy versus capacity. We give it all to them as a bundled package. Because it's base load power, we can use our transformers and things. We have no additional integration costs. We don't come on and off the grid and have spikes and things that they need to deal with. We can actually offer ancillary services and change VARs and things as needed to actually add stability to the electrical grid. The price is guaranteed for 25 years. So I think this bundled product is what we are, all attributes, all intrinsic ancillary benefits are all included in that price.
Senator French.
And I think your next slide makes this clear, but just so while we're on this at this moment, that's exclusive of the road and the transmission line.
Correct.
Right. Just, Chris, thank you.
So just touching on the legislative needs and what we've been doing.
Senator Willicott.
Just for clarity, that's the wholesale price that you're looking to sell it for?
Yes.
And what's the average? Do you have any sense what the markup would be by Chugach, let's say, or MLMP?
Through the chair to Senator Wilkowski, no, I do not.
Is it typically a penny or 2 cents? Or, I mean, they're typically cooperatives, but so they're not for-profits. But I'm just trying to get a sense of how it would compare to the current rates.
Through the chair to the senator, in other states, their rate of return is fixed by the RCA or PUC in that state. And they can't exceed that. They tend to get the maximum allowable under the law. So, but I couldn't tell you what that is for each one of the cooperatives in the Rail Belt. So the legislative needs. Last legislative session, we were able to pass SB 243, and I think the commissioner touched on, we modified geothermal royalties that seemed a little bit high. We put them at kind of the national average, and we were able to cut the price we would need by 1 cent. So we lowered it from 13 to 14 cents to 12 to 13 cents. As we look to try to get to this price that utilities seem to be looking for, we're trying to brainstorm and want to ask this committee, you know, for we're a blank slate and want ideas on how do we make up this 3 cent difference, if you will. If they want 10 cents and our project's today at 13 cents, tax incentives is one way to do it. A 30% refundable tax credit would lower the price by about 2.5 cents. And I think the policy question is, you know, does the state need to step in, or does the state want to step in and reduce the impact to ratepayers, or do they feel ratepayers should borne a higher result? Because we're dealing with a fixed market. We know what the costs are for our project. We'll disclose our rate of return to the RCA because we've accepted AEA money. It's really just how do we move the needle a little bit to get utilities to jump on this type of project. My third bullet is we're happy to put the mechanisms in place that guarantee that the incentives are passed through to the ratepayer. Should the legislature do anything to drive down those costs for ratepayers, we want to make sure they get it. And again, it's because we're doubly regulated by the RCA.
Senator Wilikowski has another question.
Thank you. Do you have how much is a 30% renewable tax credit? What would the fiscal note to the state be? Do you know?
Through the chair to the senator, I don't off the top of my head, but we could calculate it. I mean, pretty easily.
But if I could, Mr. Chair, the 30% you said lowers by 2.8 cents?
2.5.
2.5, okay.
For our project. So just the legislative needs continued. You know, we're open for ideas on how to deal with transmission infrastructure, and, you know, we're always looking for additional funding for this drilling plan. But, again, just keep in mind that, you know, the PPA price dictates how much support we need on the drilling side. If we could get a 15% power purchase agreement, we could justify the transmission and road ourselves. I think the question came up earlier. The transmission and road is worth about 2 cents to the per kilowatt hour price. That's not included. So if you take our 13 cents and say, you know what, Ormat, you need to deal with the transmission and infrastructure yourself, we move that price up to, you know, 16 cents. That's where we are today. I'm happy to answer any additional questions you might have, and we're working to bring on this natural resource in Alaska, and very excited with the opportunity to try to continue the development of this project.
If I could just clarify the difference between the 2.5 cents and the 2.0 cents. As I understand, road and lines are 2.0 cents?
Correct.
And then what was the 2.5?
The 30% refundable investment tax credit, if that became law, that equates to about that in the price. So, you know, when we're looking at what could the legislature do, these are options. They're simply starting points to a discussion on, you know, what are ways to really make up that kind of 3 cent difference early on. And just to be clear, you know, we've been asked earlier, the 10 cent we're looking at is this AEA kind of put out a number of what they felt the avoided cost of electricity was as a whole across the rail belt. And that is their lowest cost energy that they can get today is kind of that model. And so the question is, you know, how do you develop renewable resources when you're comparing it against the lowest cost energy source that's available today, and how do you equate that over a 20-year life cycle, you know? And if you agree with AEA, they kind of got a upward track on the future price of energy. Other people might disagree with that, and we're kind of this risky hedge to say, if you invest a little bit more now, 20 years from now, you might be saving much greater than 3 cents, 4 or 5 cents. It's really, where do we want to be, and you know, can the legislature protect the ratepayers in the future moving forward with a longer loop view of energy?
Well, I was just going to talk to that a little bit. And I don't know if anybody in Anchorage remembers, but I remember the heated debates we had in the peninsula on Bradley Lake, which was a hydro project. And I just did a little research today, share some figures with you on the Bradley Lake development and the cost. There was a, it was a total project of $328 million. And $16 million of that was for financing, the cost of your financing. And $175 million was a direct grant from the state. There was no payback or anything. They just granted $175 million to the project. And then $137 million was what the utilities shared in the project. And so they share equally in the amount of power they get from Bradley Lake. Bradley Lake was it produces on the average between 50 and 60 megawatts. So I just thought I'd throw that out because there is a historical precedent set by the state already to participate in these type of projects that are beneficial for the state. And this is less than the Bradley Lake was, about the same amount of power generation. So.
Senator French.
Thank you. just to go back to some of the basics, it sounds like you're, and you made, I'll just say it, it sounds like you're fairly confident that you'll make 50 megawatts from the plant and you're hoping to get 100. It's kind of a ballpark number. Remind me if you know, or maybe someone on the committee remembers, what the total sort of daily electrical usage is on the South Central grid. Yeah. Does anybody know?
It's 300 summer, peak of 900 in the winter.
Excellent. Thank you.
Any further questions for Mr. Thompson? Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah. Can you talk just a minute about jobs that you think will be created from this during the construction phase and then full-time afterwards?
Sure. Through the chair, to Senator Wilkowski, great question. You know, we typically try to utilize the trades in the local market for cost and a whole slew of other issues. We use the large number of jobs comes through the construction of the facility and the ancillary infrastructure that may be needed to put the project in place. And we have moderate kind of full-time jobs located at the facility itself. I could make up some numbers, but I can give you a better idea specifically for this project. You know, we're having to look at a few more full-time employees at the site because it runs 24 hours a day, and it's remoteness. So we're evaluating what it would take to kind of have a remote camp. You know, working, we're looking at kind of how Chugach modeled Beluga and seeing what would work there. But I would say, you know, no more than 40 full-time employees would be employed at the facility once it was up and operating. And, you know, during the construction phase, it can range, depending on our subcontractors, between 200 and 400 construction employees. And that typically, just to give you an idea of how that typically works, is we tend to act as the general contractor and then have four major subs, civil, mechanical, engineering, and kind of pipe work as well.
And again, how long is the construction phase?
We can build a facility in, 16 to 20 months. The construction phase, through the chair to Senator Wilkowski, it typically through the development, you know, once we know that there's a resource there, we can start, you know, we put in the order for equipment, and typically the construction of the facility doesn't delay the development. I mean, it kind of goes, if you look at this timeline, you know, we would start the plant construction in Wellfield, 2014, and have it ready to go by the time the final wells were drilled, final reinjection was in place at that time. So we really try to get them going in parallel tracks.
Seeing no further questions, Mr. Thompson, we thank you very much. And if there is any additional information that you would like to provide to the Resource Committee, please provide that to Senator Wagner's and my office, and we'll make sure that they get distributed to the entire committee. With that, we conclude Senate Resources for January 24th. We are adjourned.